So today I'm talking with Kimberly Ann Johnson and Stephen Jenkinson, and anybody who's reading what I'm writing knows that I reference one or both of them a number of times. The two of you are, as I say, are stars in my firmament in this dark path that I'm walking. You're a couple of the lights that are helping me see things in an interesting way. Your conversations, The Reckoning, what became The Reckoning book, have had a huge impact on me. And now you're doing another series, and it's related to things that are really important to me. I'm just going to read a quote here from the manuscript of the forthcoming matrimony book. And Stephen, you say here, dying people and dead people too, and marrying people, none of them, I'd say, have the right to take from the rest of us a crucial rite of passage by which the living are drawn down into the reality that their lives have changed irrevocably. It isn't their funeral, and it isn't theirs to take away. Nor is it their wedding. And this, the things you said about weddings when I that last podcast, that was really powerful, especially as I was training to become a wedding celebrant. It isn't their funeral, and it isn't their stick away, and it isn't their wedding. It's a village rite, a communal affirmation of the village's ways of getting on, not quite being able to. The village, or what's left of it, deserves a rite of recognition of the seismic change in their lives that matrimony would make, given half a chance. Matrimony doesn't belong to the betrothed. It belongs to the communities that live out and enforce and endure the changes in life that matrimony is supposed to bring. There is a real, palpable consequence to turning away from public ceremony, and not just for the public. Okay, so I've talked a lot. Thank you for giving me that preamble. I would love to hear you, Stephen, talk about that passage. I think I know some of the things you might say because I've heard you talk a bit about it, but why are you writing about this now?
Well, it didn't start now. It started probably 5 years ago or thereabouts. It seemed there was a kind of sequence that occurred to me, and it started with dying, as things can do. So I wrote a book about dying as it happened. Well, sorry, back up. The first book is about money. It's called Money and the Soul's Desires. So that's one of the big three or four, and then death was the next one. That's one of the big three or four, and the one that followed that was elderhood. I wish it was one of the big three or four where I live. Not really. And so what's left? You got money, you got death, you got aging. Matrimony seems right up there in consequence and trepidation with those other ones. You know, it doesn't bring with it armfuls of flowers, no matter how much we pay the florist. So, and then as it happened, some people, and you can question the wisdom of this as I've done, approached me and asked me to conduct their weddings. And I wasn't persuaded by the request, but I was persuaded by the desperation, this grim feeling that they clearly had, that all the weddings they had seen before the one they were picturing for themselves were the most tawdry and a kind of shambles, right? A shambles of what could have been and what should have been is what they seemed to come away with. And this conviction, which had no shape and no bottom to it, that it should and it must be otherwise. Why I look like the guy to deliver on that, I don't really know. But because I never trained as a celebrant. And in the process of trying to enact some of those convictions that you just read, I saw principally why weddings are the way they are now. In other words, I didn't glimpse an alternative. I glimpsed the much more bracing fact of the way it is and why it's probably that way. Why the poverties, why the 15-minute weddings, why do we return to those things if it's not just a force of habit or a failure of the imagination to come up with an alternative? And the answer I came up with is because they work. They work in the same way that an addiction works for an addict. I mean, there's no question that addictions of all kinds have a lot of efficacy for the practitioner. It's also clear that the collateral damage is beyond calculating. And that's true for the poverty of ceremony and matrimony in particular as well. So the thing I tried to do in beginning to write about it was pull apart the kind of hydra that appears, the three-headed hydra of love, marriage, matrimony, and to not use them as sub-synonyms one of the other, but to try to pull them apart and imagine that we have three different words for these things because they're three different things and they're not in a sequence of cause and effect, and they don't necessarily, I should say, they don't inevitably belong together. They have to be educated one for the sake of and in the name of the other. So love without matrimony is often what marriage becomes. And if you believe in love as the cure-all, you don't think that's a bad thing. Never mind a limited and a probably ultimately disastrous thing, but I'm persuaded that it probably is. That I
Okay,
think,
so
I'll just take the last sentence here, that love deserves matrimony. Matrimony requires love. And if that's the case, it doesn't require love as an entry-level reality. It requires love ultimately. And that's why in somewheres in the manuscript, I go out on a real limb and make a subtle and short case for the veracity of arranged marriage. Make me sound like a caveman, and well, so be it. Sorry, you were about to say that.
Well, I'm interested in the definitions, and I know that this idea of patrimony is also it's not part of that hydra-headed thing. Is it something separate, or is it another head? I'm also curious, did you perform the wedding?
Zuh, plural weddings.
Weddings.
Yeah, maybe I'm guessing six, something. It feels like that, about five or six, maybe seven altogether. Yeah. And have I sworn off the trade? Absolutely.
I got my ticket as a celebrant, and then I decided that I And most, yeah, I just was so disappointed with the lack of seriousness
Yeah.
of people who were getting married. Not that they didn't think they loved each other, but that, I have a teacher who says, if you're going to, like the being married actually means going through the process of hating each other and coming out the other side. And most people I know don't even get to that. They do get to hating each other in the divorce. But they decide to separate even before they, anyway, it just all seems so temporary. And so why would you stand up in front of people and commit to something? I had a wonderful conversation with a friend who was not happy in her marriage, talking about her wedding and how she wished they had made more of the commitments. And then the next breath was telling me, well, I think we're going to separate. And then the next breath, we were going to revisit this in 5 years anyway. And I said, I didn't hear that in your commitments. I didn't hear that this was a 5-year plan. I didn't hear that. Like, you invited me to be there, but I never heard anything about this. We're going to do this for 5 years, and then we're going to revisit this. So I think, and that's when you talk about the village, I started thinking about You haven't made commitments just to yourself. You made commitments to all of us. You dragged people from all over the world to come and witness this thing, and we had a great time. But we were there because we, and then I started thinking about, okay, we have this incredibly fractured culture, and marriage has become these little Lego building blocks that we depend on. You know, if you're going to say you're going to be that Lego building block, that means I can lean on you. Maybe I can put my Lego building block next to you, you know, and I've watched this happen in my community. As soon as one marriage falls apart, then, or one long-term relationship, then it just ripples out, and then everybody's going like, whoa.
Like
And the other
suicide.
day, yeah, I was listening to my daughter who has talked to me. She's in the social circle she's in, so she's in her mid-30s. They basically have, it's all long-term commitments and long-term marriages. There's almost no divorce. And all of a sudden somebody's talking about divorce, and it's shaking her. Like it's, and I'm, it's just really interesting to watch. It's like, oh wow, like this is,
Can
these
we go
people
back
who,
to that question that you had about if the love, marriage, and matrimony are one head, then where does patrimony live with that?
that's good. I mean, that's a thank you. I just see it's so fragmented, and so I understand, and I certainly sympathize with your not wanting to be part of that, marrying people. But where does patrimony fit into this?
No, that's not why. Before I get to the patrimony
Yeah.
question, which is a great one, the reason that I stopped doing it was because there's only so many wounds that one can endure. It's like being gummed to death by ducks. That's what conducting the ceremony of matrimony in a ceremonially illiterate place and time exposes you to. All these little, often not very subtle or elegant or eloquent disapprovals. Nobody goes to a wedding to change the world. But I did. And I paid for being the only person who was willing to do so, who saw the necessity of doing so. So here's a question. Why is matrimony or marriage, let me use the word marriage. Why is marriage so much like the mafia?
I don't know.
Well, here's it's a resemblance. So relatively easy to get into, so insanely difficult to get out of. So why? Shouldn't it be the other way around? Shouldn't you have to qualify for marriage? I mean, really qualify. I mean, really bone up on the whole matter. Learn and acquire the tuition and go through the apprenticeship and pay the steep prices and lose all the illusions and forego hating the other guy and engage your capacity to hate the other guy that you claim to love before you enter into it, and so on and so on. So weddings become 15-minute affairs now to control for all of that, to make sure, in my opinion, that nothing happens on that day. Not nothing untowards, nothing at all. And that's why the invitations tend to say, please join us. We request the honor of your company, the celebration of the love of so-and-so for so-and-so. Sounds great. Something missing though. Matrimony has nothing to do with the love of so and so for so and so. It is simply employs the feelings as the occasion for something big and overhauling possibly taking place. And the 15-minute wedding short circuits those possibilities completely and makes sure that none of them happen so that all you have is an affirmation of something, a feeling state that already exists and if we can be frank with each other, is clearly temporary. The weather of romantic love is a temporary condition. It's a fitful piece of weather. And that's, I don't think that's in any way cynical to acknowledge. In other words, matrimony is the engagement with the 360 degrees of the proposition, not the part that you love. So as to the match, excuse me, the patrimony question, I mean, this is a big take, you know, so I'll try to collapse it into something that's digestible in a few minutes. So as Kim said, patrimony as a word virtually never seems to appear in my comings and goings. I don't know that I've ever heard the word used. So one day I just thought this thought apropos of nothing in particular. Why is it that people are welcomed or invited to participate or observe or witness two people entering into quote unquote the holy state of matrimony with no parallel invitation up and down the scale of the human lifespan to enter into anything like a corollary holy or sacred reality called the state of patrimony? Why is that? So you could, you know, just gripe about it, or you could observe that maybe it's not a fit of exclusion. Maybe it's not an indication that something's wrong. Maybe there's an architectural necessity to matrimony and patrimony not being two sides of the same coin, kind of equidistant one from the other. And depending on your preference, you just imbibe one and let the other one age. So I'm imagining that there's a necessity to the separation between these two things. And I'm imagining this, the necessity is, like I said a minute ago, architectural. And maybe it goes like this. It would appear to be the case, I know Kim knows more about this than me, that the mammalian reproductive system in general is highly sensitized to the sustaining environment in which it finds itself. And that's probably true biochemically and in every sense spiritually and everything in between those two things. And one of its sensibilities, one of its intelligences, as I understand it, is it's not likely to vote yes for reproduction in circumstances that are less than promising. And can be characterized by, you know, gross indecision and uncertainty of the likelihoods of sustenance in the near future, of all kinds, sort of wear and tear on the sense of well-being, things like this. This is where patrimony comes in. I think ancestrally, going back now, not a few hundred years, but many thousands of years. I think our little corner of the mammalian family, you know, life ways included the following: that a woman was unlikely, either in terms of her deliberations or in terms of her chemistry, to submit herself to the demonstrable ravages of reproduction and the far from guaranteed likelihood of its success at the at come term, without a reasonable reassurance that all is not up in the air as a result of doing so, that there's a kind of an enabling environment that precedes procreation and enables procreation. That enabling environment is what we mean, I think, by the word patrimony. Patrimony, you could say explicitly, the word means the nature or the manner of fathering. The specifics of the fathering have to do with home making. And one of the cruel ironies of our last some, I don't know, a couple hundred years is that the word homemaker has been used exclusively as an attribute of the feminine. And there's a tremendous loss of this understanding of patrimony that's manifest in the misapprehension of the word and the segregation of the word to be characterized as something that's principally maternal, matriarchal, and matrimonial. But I'm suggesting to you here, and I'll stop with this, that matrimony requires patrimony as its predecessor as a verb. What would it be? Anyway,
Predecessing?
yeah,
I don't
I
like
know, I
that,
can't
yeah.
think of a word. What it requires is that patrimony comes first and it agrees to submit itself to the long-term project of making a home for this new life. And the new life is not only the possibility of a child 9 months down the road. The new life is what matrimony evokes, and the child is one iteration of that. But the lion's share of the realities that matrimony is there to inculcate are cultural or village scaled things. That's a little brief overview.
So, Kimberly Ann, you recently got married. And
Yes.
so all of these things are floating, all these thoughts are floating around you. They're in the context of you getting married. Can you? I'd love to hear about what that was like, what that was like to consider what marriage would be given these kind of thoughts.
Yeah, I got married. So right now we're in late January, and I got married last summer in July. And I was fortunate because I was on the farm, the Orphan Wisdom School farm, several weeks prior to getting married. So a few of the women who live there who have been a part of marriages that Stephen has officiated or conducted were there too. And so at certain moments, they would kind of pull me aside and share a thing or two about what a honeymoon was like for their wedding, what happened when they had a honeymoon, or somebody else would pull me aside and say, you know what it's like to take care of a woman in her third trimester. Well, you're in that trimester now as a single woman, and so keep that in mind. And then, because I got married in Brazil, which is where my husband is from, and also where he lives right now, I was getting married in another culture that does have some patrimony. That's a word that they use in their culture frequently. So I hadn't really heard of it in English, other than in maybe an anthropology textbook, like cultural patrimony meaning physical, tangible, material objects. Until I started working with Stephen Jenkinson. And so, in some ways, I was fortunate because I had something to walk into that already had some tread to it. So, for example, invitations is always a big deal in any wedding, right? Who gets invited? How many people can there be? The groom's list, the bride's list. Going down the list and Xing people off, or how much can you afford, right? That's a big part because it's expensive. So you're going like per head, how can you afford? Well, where I got married was in my husband's spiritual, it's a hard thing to translate, but what it is a house with a piece of land next to it that has lots of separate small buildings that each belong to different
Duties.
deities. And so that's the place where ceremony happens often, and ones that he participates in and ones that he doesn't. But there's personal objects of his that live in some of those rooms. Like, for instance, his dreadlocks live in the room of one of the deities. So when it came time to inviting people to come, a third of the people, roughly, were people that he invited, a third were people I invited, and a third were people who are just part of that place. So people that I've never even met or seen before. So that's kind of a strange concept for an Anglo-North American to imagine that you would have a lot of people that would be coming to your wedding that you don't even know. And if you were going to go a little farther down that line, although I was already so much out of my own context that I wasn't really thinking. Also, US dollars are really valuable in Brazil right now. So it wasn't a question of. I think if it was inverse, then it might have even been more disruptive to me to imagine, like, oh my God, and then we're paying for all these people that I don't even know, kind of thing. I didn't so much have that sensation, but it was just like, wow, okay, there's going to be a lot of people there that I've never seen. And most of the people he had seen, but not all. But that's just one example of. It was just part of it. If you are going to be married in this place, the people who take care of this place will be there. And the people who have some of them for 25 years, some of them. So the person who married us is called a Pai de Santo. And he has been a Pai de Santo since he was 9 years old and he's in his 50s. And he had only done four weddings. So a year prior, well, actually, a year and a half. We went to meet to just talk about it. And then my daughter, I have one daughter, and my husband doesn't have any children. Me and my daughter did certain things that we needed to prepare ourselves for that. And then the week before the wedding, we went back to the same place and we got different preparations that had to do with offerings, ceremonial baths. Sleeping in certain rooms, certain deities that are related to the place and then related to me and related to my husband and related to my daughter. So, and some of those were optional and some of those weren't, but that's what I felt I needed to do because I didn't feel that I'm a person who is very permeable in some ways. And so I knew if I was in someone else's ancestral grounds, that if I wasn't prepared, that I could, there's certain drum beats that call in certain entities. And that's a part of the ceremony is one by one, the drum beats change and the songs change to call it in. And I knew that I wanted to feel purified at that moment. So that I was arriving at that moment clear of things that would keep me from being able to enter and have something really happen, as Stephen mentioned, that it wasn't symbolic, that some we were allowing ourselves to be transformed. And I think just because I'm almost 50 and I've been through other transformations, which in the spiritual world sounds like really great, right? We're gonna get transformed, it sounds awesome. And I've been through enough of them that I knew that there was probably pain and discomfort and heartbreak involved in it as well. Although I had no idea how that was going to happen, and the ways that it happened really were very visceral. So, for one example, the trying to get the sequence right, but I think it was the day of the wedding. I really understood why it's the father that walks you down the aisle. In this case, it actually my mom and my dad did because that was what was asked of me at the place. And my husband was walked down by his mom, his biological mom on one side, the mother that raised him on the other side, and his spiritual mother behind him. So he had three people. But I felt a visceral like tearing behind my heart, like my dad was getting like ripped out of my body the day that I was going to do that, and I could feel it. And I even called him and told him like I feel this, and I feel that I'm not belonging to you in the same way now, and I'm gonna belong to someone else. And he was calling me every day for that 10-day period or something. And, he didn't, I just understood what death was going to be like a little bit more too at that moment. And he maybe couldn't meet me in that place at that time, but he at least listened to me. So there were just certain things that would be easy to discard as formality. Oh, that's patriarchal formality. Why does it have to be the dad? Why is the dad doing this? What do you mean giving away? That sounds like I'm an object. Why would I allow myself to be given away as an object? I'm not a thing. I don't, nobody owns me. But for me, that's what I felt as it was happening. And the most extreme thing that I felt was the night before that my daughter called me into my room, and we'd already had conversations about our life changing a lot as a family of two and having a third be in our dynamic. But it was I mean, people could hear me downstairs wailing because when she started to talk to me about how she really wanted this for me and that she'd really been praying and wishing for this, but she knew that it was going to be so different and she had to let me go now. It was just guttural, visceral, separation. So, ending.
Endings, yeah, endings without end. That's what matrimony is.
So
How
I
does
feel that I was very blessed. Another thing, I'll stop after this, but another thing was just one of the things that Stephen talks about is blessing, and that the word comes from the word blood. And so, this kind of airy fairy blessings to you, kind of like sparkle dust, doesn't quite give the feeling of what a true blessing could be. And I was also really lucky because in my husband's culture, there's a lot of ways that people. So, for instance, he used to go upstairs to his grandparents every day, every night at 6:30 or so, and say to them, "Ben samoy," which means bless me. And so, and then the person would respond, "Deus chiaban soy," God bless you. So, in his, where he lives, which is Salvador Bahia, the older people and people who were raised in a certain way, they know that language. So even if I just come next to someone and bow my head and get a little bit lower, they know that that's what I'm doing. And so I had a group of people with me the day before we got married, and we were taking them on a tour of the old city. My husband's religion is an Afro-Brazilian religion called Candomblé. And so we were going on a tour through sort of the African pathway through that city, which actually is very dark because there's slave auction spots and dungeons and a lot of remnants of the time that that was where the slave trade came and the Atlantic slave trade came. So as we were doing that, I was saying to people, like, we went to this one store where there was a wood carver that makes the statues of the deities. And he was talking about his trade. And so then I would say, "Well, I've brought these people to you. And these are the reason is because tomorrow we're having a wedding and I'm getting married." And I, everywhere that I went, people just started hugging me and then whispering in my ear and praying and just weeping and weeping with me. Like it happened for days on end that people just somehow understood because I also was bowing to them as I was telling that. And so it gave the deities a lot of opportunities to appear and be together with us in the makings of bringing people together for that ceremony.
So imagine, before you jump in, imagine all of that gone. Imagine all of that dispelled, all of the three dimensionality of that, the stuff that has nothing to do with your feelings about it, the kind of holy architecture of the thing, all gone. What would you do instead? The answer is you don't have to imagine. That's what we have. We have the goneness of everything that Kim, basically everything that Kim just described. That is our sophistication, and that's our poverty.
My response to not wanting to marry people was that I said I would. I put together this thing called, it was a, like, you know, a 6 month program that you would do with me where I would make you suffer. You know, I would make you somehow try to talk about what marriage was beyond the 15 minutes of excitement. Not, nothing like what you're talking about, but some way of getting, sharing what I knew and making people go through something. And nobody's taking me up on that offer. So yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. I'm curious what it's. So that was a almost a year and a half ago, or was that 6 months ago? I can't remember what the timeline is here. Yeah. So he's in Brazil and you're here. You were in a, you were, you know, deeply embedded in this culture, in this village. So much history, so much palpable history. And now you're living in, you know, white bread Southern Cal or California somewhere. And how are you? How is that?
How's that, Kim?
Well, it's not that the wedding was some comfortable thing, right?
No,
Because
that's not what I assumed. No, it sounds
right,
really
yeah, there's a
hard.
lot of well, I'll say this. Everybody says to you, your wedding is about you, right? I had friends pull me aside to tell me this wedding, it's about you. So you do what you want to do. So that goes for who you invite. Oh, you're worried. Should you invite this person or not? Well, how are you going to feel about this? And it's your day, and make it your day. And my wedding actually wasn't my day. And I didn't see my husband really very much at all for the weeks prior because he was organizing everything and considering all of these little wishes that I had said along the way and trying to bring those wishes to fruition. And in my mind, I thought, oh, you know, we're going to be together every day and we're going to be able to like talk to all these people that are coming from around the world. I think some people were disappointed because they spent so little time with him. They came thinking they were going to get time with him and he wasn't around. It was, you know, the day after the wedding, we called it, I think we were calling it a collective honeymoon because we had so many people that were from abroad and we also had people to thank. So, for instance, our dishes we had made in this village that used to only send dishes by boat because it rocked instead of bounced. And the people handmade and hand painted the dishes. We wanted to go back there and say thank you for everything that they made for us. And there's only so much time that I was going to be in Brazil. So the other side of the ceremony, right? It's not, I think here in meaning Anglo North America, you're supposed to be whisked away and everybody else is supposed to be taking care of everything for you. And in our case, like we had things we needed to take care of on the other side of it. So I don't think either of us felt cheated because of that, because I think both of us are, were him probably more, but just by disposition and the fact that this is his culture, so that way of doing things is probably more. Although he had never been to a wedding in the religion that he practices, so because it's not very usual. He's still there because he doesn't have a US visa, so it's an immigration policy and a waiting game, not because he doesn't want to be here. And I don't want to take us in a completely different direction, but part of the work that I've been doing since I met Stephen is trying to understand this constant desire to be somewhere else other than where I am, and imagine that this other place has so many things that we don't have here, which is true. I just told a story of how this other place does have all those other things, but it's not my place. And I've been making a project of trying to belong to where I'm from.
So you had this incredibly, as you said, transformative experience. It was visceral, it's in your body. It wasn't just something you dreamt up. But you're out of that village now. So how does it live in you, or does it live in you? Or how do you know, to go back to like the poverty of this culture? I mean, I just live up the coast from you. We have lots of the same, we might as well be the same place. We're the California of Canada, you know. So how do we do this? How do you take what you learned, what your body learned there, and live that here? And particularly, you have a daughter, you know, and at some point she will start imagining herself romantically, or looking at weddings and stuff like that. And I mean, this how do you live what you experience? How does that live in you? That I'm curious about that.
Well, it lives beyond me because, for instance, the occasion of my wedding, my husband has three half brothers, and his mother, who is the mother of those four sons, those sons hadn't been together for 7 years. And now they're reconnected. Both of his moms needed new teeth, and the wedding was the occasion for them to get
I
their
love
teeth
that
fixed.
detail. I love that.
So now they have teeth that are not
That
only,
work.
yeah, well,
Yeah.
and they have more teeth because
Yeah.
they didn't have, one of them didn't have very many. So now she has teeth in her mouth and she doesn't have to hide her smile. So it's lived beyond me, and in what people saw that the people who came from North America hadn't ever seen anything like that for many different reasons. How do I live that here? I don't. But I'm not miserable here because it's not the same either. So I'm probably, I try to care a little bit more for my parents, probably. I attempt to imagine farther down the road and what I'm contributing to farther down the road that I can begin now. As far as my daughter's concerned, I'm just on her to put it on her life plan to get married and have babies before she's 30, if she's going to do that. Because this whole find yourself, do sow your oats, do your thing, and then what?
Get your money.
Get your money, yeah, be financially secure, and then do that next step. It's not working out well for women. So I'm just basically on her and all her friends all the time of like, okay, if you want to do this, then don't be conditioned the way that I was, which is, you have until you're 40 and don't rush, and you're going to lose your professional standing if you drop out of the market for a couple of years. So I'm just flat out being an annoying person and saying, don't think that it's sequential like that. You don't have to quote unquote grow up to children grow you up. So if you need to do that, especially biologically, because as you know, I work with women and I work with women that are doing everything from surrogacy to egg donation to all of the technological interventions, also bereft because they're in their late 30s and don't have a partner, but do want the child. And I just am encouraging her to think about it differently because it is a matter of changing perception. It is a matter of obeying an order. There is an order. And if you don't obey that order somehow, you end up somewhere that you probably don't want to be.
Yeah, and I can I get it. I have two daughters, and lots of stuff rings true. And I talk to and see lots of women, and yeah, what's happening is not working for women for sure. I don't think it's working for men, but most of us haven't figured that out, or aren't too upset unless our hockey team isn't winning. But where's the marriage or the matrimony and patrimony piece in this for your daughter? So I look at
Okay,
my.
I just have to, because I remember this came up last time we talked to you. I have to ask you about this part, because so when I say it's not working for women, I'm not saying anything about men directly. I'm not saying it's working for one and not working for the other, because it's not a scale that tips one side and then tips the other side. And I think we could say it's not working for men from what I hear, based on suicidality, based on depression, based on just flat out anger, right? All kinds of reasons that it's not working. I don't think people, maybe for women, it's more obvious because of the reproductive window. But I wouldn't say that most people are feeling like they have a strong sense of what the culture and community either has to support them, or how they could feed it or support it.
Say
So
that
I'm not
again.
saying I think that women are specific victims here at all.
No.
I
And I'm
think
not hearing that. I'm not hearing that, Kimberly. And what my thoughts are that this is not working out for most of us, and lots of us think that basically more is better, faster is better, things don't matter. I'm just here to accumulate more stuff. Or more sexual experiences, or and relationships come and go. And I guess that's my big thing, is that people don't take relationships seriously enough, because I think as soon as I become intimate with anyone, whether it's sexually intimate or emotionally intimate or spiritually intimate, I want that little thing to blossom. I want it to become more. And if it doesn't, there's a little bit of pain there. And the more times I feel that it doesn't go anywhere, the less likely I am to actually open up. So when I look at things like, so with things that you said earlier, Stephen, I can't remember exactly what it was, but I had a conversation again with my daughter several years ago where she took it as a rant against divorce. And I said, no, I'm not against divorce. I just think people break up too easy. And now I realize that the problem isn't that they break up too easy. They get together too easy. I don't get to know you deeply enough before I'm all of a sudden opening in a woman's case, I'm opening up my body to you. Or in a man's case, my experience, I'm taking myself to a place of vulnerability that part of me really wants to be there, but I'm scared shitless to be there. And so I close up really quickly if things don't feel right. And so I see lots of this around me where, the whole hookup culture, I mean, I've heard you talk with other guests about this, the confusion of sexuality with intimacy, the confusion with a wedding, with some kind of, with love, with anything that means anything beyond that you just brought some people together and had a party. I'm watching my daughters, and I have two sons, two stepsons, and two daughters. And the one daughter's doing a very conventional thing, and the other daughter's doing a very unconventional thing, but they both have what I would consider solid relationships. One is actually married, the other one, whether they get married or not, it feels like that's solid. And one of my sons, it feels like that's solid. But I'm curious about, and I talk to them about this a lot, what do these relationships mean to you? like you've watched your parents set really bad examples. Like, why aren't you going to do exactly the same thing? Like, what can I do to support you to do, something different than what your mother and father and mothers and fathers have been doing? So you're encouraging your daughter to, if she wants to have children, to do that sooner rather than later, than not to wait, all that kind of stuff. But where does marriage fit in there? And where does, in a culture that, where basically most men are scared of commitment, we don't feel like we have to commit for lots of the stuff that we want. We don't realize what we really want until it's gone so often. Then, yes, we're alone, we're suicidal, and
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I would ask you, do you think that's true that most men are afraid of commitment?
no.
Okay, that really isn't my question. My question is to you, as with your daughter, is where does the marriage piece fit in there? So you're encouraging her to have,
I would like her to get married and then have a baby, if that's what she, if she wants to be a mother. Then I would like her to get married first and then children. So, these days that probably sounds like I, came out of Little House on the Prairie. Because people would say, what difference does it make, right? Like I got, and then people start giving you all the exceptions, right? It's like the same thing that people tell you, oh, well, I slept with the person on the first date and then we got married, even though that's the by far the exception of how that's going to work out. That's what people. So, and also people, when they hear this, they take it as a moral thing. They think that I'm saying that it's bad or wrong, or maybe they even think I'm like a fundamentalist Christian or something, that I think people have to get married in the eyes of God before before they're worthy to do something else. I'm talking more about something that probably tracks slightly physiologically, and then from the culture point of view. Because it wouldn't just be about her. It would be about what I think needs to be in place as a broader base of anchoring to bring new life into the world.
Patrimony, in other words.
Well, I'm with you there. Just how I, like I said, I feel really lucky that my daughters are with the men they're with right now. But I see lots of young women struggling with that because,
With choosing partners.
yeah, because lots of us men, we may not be afraid of commitment. Well, I don't know. We're afraid of something, or we're being let off. I'm actually really heartened by what seems to be a small incoming tide of women, at least on social media, saying, like, don't give yourself away. Like, don't sell yourself short. Don't sell yourself short. And it's not just about sex, and there's a lot more. But I don't see that on the men's side. I mean, I do see, certainly men in their 40s and 50s talking about that kind of stuff, but younger men, we're still in a conquest, take all we can get kind of mode. And I think this is something that I heard you say at one point or reference, Stephen. I can't remember I can't even paraphrase the quote, but my response to it was that my generation, and I'm close enough in age to you that I would consider you part of my generation and my father's generation and the generation before, we've let our sons and our grandsons down. Our nephews down because they're where they are right now with a lot of frustration and a lot of anger because not enough of us taught them how to live. And maybe that's—I mean—that's what I see your work is about, Stephen. Is so much trying to find a way to live in a time that doesn't have a lot of death to it.
You know, it didn't
But
start 20 years ago. It's the dilemma you're
no,
articulating.
yeah, no, I
So
know.
it's important if you're going to engage at the level of condemnation and blame, that you allow in the distinct possibility that the people who are the culprits at the center of the dilemma you just described were not themselves served by by what they themselves can't seem to deliver on.
No, I understand that, and I feel like,
You got to be able to say it too. Understanding it is not enough, because you know the condemnation of people of your generation that you just engaged in doesn't do anything to further the dilemma that you're articulating. I don't think it does. I mean, is it accurate as far as it goes? In a kind of bloodless way, it's accurate, yes. But is it redemptive in any way at all? And m for me, the answer is probably not. You know, the lion's share of young men who, let's say, stumble across my path generally are trying to keep their heads down. They're not the opportunists as you've characterized the situation. They're trying to survive, and they don't know what the deal is. They don't know what the rules are. And you know, with good reason, they don't know what the rules are. And you know, it's the nuclear family that's the locus of this poverty. The inability of the nuclear family to compensate for the goneness of a culture is the principal dilemma that we're talking about here in roundabout ways. I mean, properly roundabout ways. So that's the appeal I keep trying to make here is that, you know, there's a young man who came to visit us. He just left yesterday. And he started talking with me as we're on a walk here about, you know, he's using all the vernacular that I can't reproduce. I can't even do it now for you about colonists and
Appropriation
that
and
whole drill. And, you know, I said to him, as it should try to recompense in his soul the fact that he's talking about himself, even though he thinks he's talking about what he's realized. But all the poverties that he's describing accrue to people who look and sound and move and operate just like him. And so I said to him, can you imagine that to go along with the pain and the unwelcome scrutiny that goes with realizing that you've been an unwitting or otherwise, but let's say for the moment, unwitting vector for a lot of dark historical themes and trends and actions. Can you imagine to go along with that? There's another fact that you don't hear talked about at all, which is these people who are ostensibly the bad guys in virtually every social justice scenario that's played out. Most, if not all of them, have they've not already done so, will soon enough awaken to the excruciating and irreducible cultural poverty that induced such behavior and mindlessness in them in the first place. And this is not to do anything about personal responsibility for personal action, but it has an awful lot to do with why, even if we mean well, we don't seem to be able to do well. It's a bigger story than personal culpability. Just as matrimony is a bigger story than how two people feel about each other.
I think that's probably a good stopping point because we're a little over the hour and
Yeah, thank you.
seems like a natural pause. Stop. Yeah. Thank
Yeah,
you.
thank you. Thank you very much for your time and your words, both of you.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.